Hi, this is Barry List Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Artificial intelligence and other techniques are rapidly improving the way that scientists can build robots and smart programs that improve our lives. But how close can we come to creating a program that allows computers to match wits with exceptionally bright people? In today's segment, we talk to Stephen Baker, the author of Final Jeopardy, Man vs. Machine and the Quest to Know Everything. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. His book tells the story of Watson, IBM's computer that goes up against humans in the TV show Jeopardy this month, February 2011. Steve, welcome to The Science of Better.
Thanks, Barry.
A couple of warm-up questions. Our listeners tend to use or appreciate math, and math is the way that we first crossed paths. In your former role as a reporter with Business Week, you first wrote a cover story about ways that math will change the world, then a book called The Numerati. How did the impact of math on business first come to your attention?
I was doing a story for Business Week on the decline of the U.S. tech industry, or at least what I perceived to be the decline, and it seemed like such a familiar story that the editors at Business Week urged me to look for a fresher angle, and one of them suggested that math was an important area that people were overlooking, and it was really crucial as a competitive issue as in societies. And so they told me to do a cover story on math, but I really didn't know where to look. And I ended up doing this story that was basically much more of a data story than a pure math story. It was looking at how organizations can analyze the data of their workers, their consumers, their patients, their citizens, to try to sell them more products, handle them more efficiently, make the society safer, et cetera. And it seemed to me to be a major issue for all of business, was how to handle this data and how to drive intelligence from it. And of course, I got a lot of help from people in operations research, which is a crucial element in this whole story. And then I wrote the book, The Numerati, which deepened the same reporting.
What are Numerati, and what did that book explore?
The Numerati, I came up with this name for people who dive into the data and build new businesses and new industries from the analysis of data. And I call them the Numerati. And the book looked at, from a consumer's point of view, or from a citizen's point of view, the book looked at how we are understood by these people as shoppers, voters, patients, potential terrorists, etc.
One of the chapters in that book explored research at IBM. Is that how you first learned about Watson?
Oh, no. I didn't learn about Watson until much later. The chapter in The Numerati that dealt with the research at IBM looked at the team in IBM research around Samer Tekridi, who was at that point heading stochastic analysis at IBM. And they were trying to build statistical mathematical models, predictive mathematical models of 50,000 of the IBM workers, and using those to attempt to optimize the workforce. Well, that was my chapter, The Worker.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really get to Watson until fall of 2009. I was still working for Business Week, and I was talking to people at IBM, and they told me about the Watson, the Jeopardy match, and I thought, boy, this is the perfect subject for a book, because it has a great story where you begin with, a machine that really can't do anything, and by the end, you've got a machine that's going to be facing the greatest Jeopardy players in the world on a nationally televised event.
A lot of us remember when IBM built Deep Blue. From their end, was there a connection between one and the other?
Well, there is a connection, in terms of there might be some connections in terms of, massively parallel architectures. And there's also a connection in that they're each what they call grand challenges. And IBM needs these grand challenges both to advance technology and to put the spotlight on the company. Because the company doesn't have the consumer recognition that it used to have when people used to be able to buy IBM products. And it's sort of obscured in the marketplace by sort of sexier products from companies like Apple and Google. And so IBM needs this for attention, and it also to drive the science. So they did the chess match, and that was sort of state of the art in the 90s, and it was a machine that could analyze trillions of possible combinations and come up with the best moves for each moment in the chess game. But they needed something else to follow that up, and they looked at the amount of unstructured data that was pouring into networks, the words and images, and they said, we need something that makes sense of language. And they settled upon Jeopardy as the best test for this, because to get a machine that can understand complex language, dive into very deep pools of unstructured and chaotic data, and within seconds come up with an answer that it can bet on, was a really great challenge. And plus, they get the platform of Jeopardy, so they have 9 million people watching it every night.
That doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
So how long did it take to develop, and how much did it ultimately cost?
Well, they won't tell me how much it cost. I did a back of the envelope on that, and if you just add up they had a team of 25 to 30 PhDs working on this for the best part of 4 years.
Wow.
And so I came up with what I think is an extremely conservative estimate of $30 million, but I think it probably cost perhaps a multiple of that, but I don't know. They won't say. It took 4 years.
And why was it named Watson?
It's named after the founder of IBM, Thomas J. Watson. And it's also, Sherlock Holmes' assistant is a Dr. Watson. They thought of that.
And what does the computer look like?
Well, the body of the computer, it's basically a cluster of computers. It's in a refrigerated room, and it is racks of Power 7 servers that fit into big things that look like huge restaurant refrigerators. It features now 2,880 computer cores, and so it's a massively parallel operation. But what you'll see on television isn't the computing apparatus. What you're going to see is just a computer screen with an orb on it that is Watson's avatar, and it's supposed to represent Watson's sort of cognitive processes.
And as I recall, a lot of thought was put into what the face of Watson should look like.
Yeah, they were worried about Watson being too human. The whole question was, people are sometimes a little bit scared of super smart computers, and especially computers that act like humans and battle against humans in matches like this one. And so they were very careful to calibrate Watson's voice to make it not too human, so you can identify that it's a machine, and then they did not give it any human features on its face. It's just, it looks almost like the Earth itself, with all the, I describe it as the Earth with jets streaming over it, the passage of jets.
So some science fiction fans who might recall the computer HAL from 2001 won't be too frightened by Watson.
Well, that was one of the things that they were really focusing on, even as they were deliberating about what its avatar would look like. The chief scientist, David Ferrucci, was on the Internet looking at images of HAL and saying, stay away from kind of pulsating red globes, because that will recall HAL. And HAL was something they really wanted to stay away from. And I think it's important to note here, Barry, I'm sure we'll go into what this computer can and can't do, but this computer is so far away from the kind of technology that can have its own agenda and has, desires and thoughts that a computer like HAL could have. We're still very far away from that type of intelligent machinery.
In case some of our listeners aren't acquainted with the game Jeopardy, could you give a little outline?
Yeah, Jeopardy is a knowledge game. And it involves, there are three people who play against each other, and the odd thing about Jeopardy is that what you would think of as questions are really posed as phrases or answers, and you have to come up, your response is what is the question that leads to that answer. And so everything that the contestants say has to be framed as a question. And after the clue is shown, and the host, Alex Trebek, reads it. And it's only when he's finished reading it that a light goes on telling them that they can buzz to answer the question and get money. And if they, and so the first one to buzz gets to answer it. And if that person gets it right, he or she gets that much money. If they miss it, they lose that much money. So Watson really has to calibrate its know how much it knows, which is a really tricky thing for a computer. How sure is it that it has the right answer? And is it sure enough that it can bet? That is at the heart of the sophistication of this computer, its knowledge of what it knows.
And in the introduction to the book, you paint a picture of the test match for Watson and a question involving a former Israeli general. You want to tell us a little bit how that fits in with what you were just saying?
Yeah, I mean, it was the scene that I discussed, and it was in an excerpt in the Wall Street Journal if people wanted to look for it. It was the question was something about it was something about eyes. Eye marks the spot or something like that. The category was, and this one was, this facial wear was made famous or synonymous with the Israeli general Moshe Dayan. So a lot of people, especially in our generation, who remember this Israeli general who in the 70s, remember his picture. He was probably on the cover of Time magazine with an eye patch. And anybody who knew him knew that he wore an eye patch. And so humans who know that instantaneously, or pretty quickly at least. And there was one very talented Jeopardy player who was playing against Watson. His name was Justin Birnbach, and he knew it, and he was pressing that button. But in the time that Alex Trebek read that clue, Watson was going on an exhaustive search about everything about Moshe Dayan. Who was he? What did he wear? And then when it came back with the answer, eye patch, Watson had to say, is eye patch, had to do all this double checking. Is Moshe Dayan a man? Is he an Israeli? Did he wear an eye patch? And so it carries on just exhaustive research project over the course of 3 seconds. And at the moment that Alex Trebek finished reading that sentence, Watson pressed the button and beat Justin Birnbach to it. That was just one example and one clue just to show how Watson responds to a single clue.
And what's going to be happening in the big 3-day Final Jeopardy contest?
Well, in the 3-day Final Jeopardy contest, see, Watson, over the course of the last year, has played a lot of humans in Jeopardy. A year ago, it had a long series against people that were pretty good Jeopardy players that had been on the show and had won maybe one time, but not more than twice. Then Watson played, in the fall, it played against people who had qualified for the Tournament of Champions. So this is like the top stock of Jeopardy players. And it won close to 7 out of 10 matches against those people. And on Valentine's Day and the 2 days after it, it's going to be playing against the two greatest Jeopardy champions ever, Ken Jennings, who in 2004 won 74 straight matches, and Brad Rutter, who has never lost a game in Jeopardy and has beaten Ken Jennings thoroughly in the 2 times that they've played.
We touched on this a little bit before, but maybe we can expand. What mechanics and accommodations to human thought and language are required from a computer or a computer program to compete with people in a game like this?
You mean, what do they have to teach the computer to compete with people?
Yes.
They have to, first of all, the most difficult thing to teach the computer is language. The computer is extremely handicapped when it comes to the nuance of words, the context of language. One of the challenges for Watson was to read a Jeopardy clue and to know what it was supposed to look for. You know, is the George Washington that it mentions in this clue, is that the man George Washington, the bridge George Washington? Does it have to do with Washington State? We know those things automatically, and they have to teach Watson exhaustively so that it can figure out what they call the lexical answer type, or LAT, which is exactly if it's looking for a person, a place, a thing, a president, a bridge, whatever it's looking for. So a lot of work goes into that.
How do the researchers input facts and knowledge? Do they just download every article that appears in Wikipedia?
Well, first of all, Watson cannot go onto the Internet. Just like any other Jeopardy player, it has to depend on knowledge that it has in its apparatus, in its what would be a person. So they downloaded a lot of stuff, and from, you know, Wikipedia's in there, and a lot of encyclopedia entries, a lot of lists, a lot of ontologies. But they had to watch out, because if you download, like, the entire Bible, let's say, if you download the entire Bible, there is a lot of noise in there that could distract Watson, because Watson, you know, every word sends it off on a hunt, even if the word is not relevant to what it should be looking for. They ended up putting about 75 gigabytes of data into Watson of documents. And if you think about it, that's not that much. I mean, you can fit 75 gigabytes onto an iPod very easily these days. But they had to make it small because Watson doesn't have that much time, and if it looked through a lot of data, it would get more confused and it would take more time. So it's carefully calibrated. The question is, see, you'll see this thing, you'll say, geez, this machine knows everything. I mean, it answers questions on you know, history and on music and on popular culture, and it seems to know a really, really broad range of things. The question is whether Watson can be, you know, for next generations of Watson can be calibrated for specific domains. And if you can have a Watson that can become an expert and answer questions about software design or about medical diagnostics or about, you know, law, and that's going to be the challenge.
Yeah, and we might go into that a little bit more afterward. I thought I might take you back to the development of this computer. What were the stages like in developing this, just briefly?
See, IBM had already had an effort, ongoing effort, in question-answering technology. I mean, it's a field of artificial intelligence that's been around for a long time. So they had a team, about five or six people, that was developing question-answering technology, and they would participate every year in government-run tests. The questions in these tests were much simpler than Jeopardy. They're much more straightforward, and they were based on sort of, you know, a corpus of several thousand documents that the government provided all the teams. And IBM's team could really never get above a 35% rate of accuracy.
Hmm.
And so that was... And they weren't alone. That was basically where everybody was, except for one team that got 70% but never disclosed how they were getting it. Anyway, so they seemed pretty stuck. So when IBM came up with this idea for the Jeopardy challenge, it was assumed that they would build it upon the platform that they already had in-house. And David Ferrucci, the chief scientist, knew that that platform was incapable of creating a viable Jeopardy machine. But he had to basically convince everyone in IBM that they needed to start anew. So what he did, and I thought was really interesting, was he got one of his new PhDs, who wasn't really associated with question answering, to pretend that he was like a hacker in some basement, a solitary figure using the technology that's at hand, open source software and Wikipedia and Google and any tool that somebody could have, some solitary operator could have. And he got that person to build a Jeopardy question answering system in a month that would compete against the IBM in-house version. So it was called a bake-off. And these two worked on their systems, and they had the bake-off, and the solitary hacker named James Phan actually produced a system that, in many metrics, performed about as well as the in-house version. And so that proved to people two things. First, that the in-house version wasn't very good. And secondly, that there were new ideas, like several that James Phan came up with, that might lead to another platform. And so they went on another entire platform and built a system. Well, it's a big and bold system, basically, it involves creating algorithms to bring back answers. And each algorithm is a specialist. Each algorithm has its own, you know, specialty, whether it's in words that rhyme, in finding synonyms, in doing Google-like searches, in tracking down historical figures. And so when they see a clue, and when they know what the clue is looking for, it unleashes more than 100 of these algorithms, each on its own hunt. And within a second or so, these algorithms come back with their candidate answers. And the IBM system, the analytic system, knows or learns that some of the algorithms are much better in certain types of questions and others in others. And so it develops its confidence in each algorithm based on which type of question it is and its subsequent research into the viability of that answer. It's a little bit like a Darwinian system in which each one, to survive, has to thrive in a certain area of expertise.
Watson's response time was brought down from hours to seconds. What was involved in doing that?
Well, as they were developing it, Watson goes through just these ridiculous efforts to try to figure out what the answer is. And initially it took between an hour and a half and two hours for the system to bring back a Jeopardy clue. And they had to get it down to 3 seconds. And so they built a massively parallel system, and they distributed the work to more than 2,000 computing cores. They developed this type of architecture for to speed it up, and they did so. And they also, to speed it up further, distributing it alone could not bring down the time. Another thing they did to bring down the time was they sort of pre-processed those 75 gigabytes of data, so that they went through and they analyzed the sentences and what's the noun and what's the verb, and they gave the computer a much easier read on its data. And that multiplied the load of data to 500 gigabytes from 75. And then they take it from the hard drives and they put it all on RAM so that the computer can access it in a split second.
You mentioned earlier that IBM needs a project like this to give it new life. I doubt that this kind of publicity and seeking verve alone is a reason for building a machine like this. What additional developments will it lead to? You mentioned specialized computing, and how will machines and programs like Watson be used in other aspects of our society, like medicine and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of IBM mostly, I mean, the largest business within IBM is IBM Global Services. And so what they do is they go around the world trying to help companies deal with the data that they have, the systems they have, and the questions that arise. And so if a lot of the data that companies are dealing with is now unstructured data. I was talking to HP, and they said that 90% of the data that they have in warehouses is unstructured. So if it is unstructured, and if that data has important insights about what customers are saying, what they're thinking, what they're communicating with each other, all kinds of other intelligence, then it makes sense for IBM to create technology that can search through this data and answer questions about it. And so some of the areas where they're hoping to use Watson are, one of them is, that they talk about a lot, is in medicine. And the idea would be that Watson would be an assistant in the diagnosis department. Now, it's important to stress that it's the assistant, because if you see it on Jeopardy, you'll notice that Watson sometimes says things that are utterly outlandish. So you can't count on it to make decisions. But if Watson looks at a series of symptoms and then consults perhaps hundreds of thousands of academic articles about those symptoms and finds certain correlations and comes back with a list of the eight most likely diseases that this person has, along with along with points to the documents that it consulted to come up with these ideas. Then the doctors themselves can look at those and say, well, three of these are off the wall, but two of them actually look kind of interesting, and we hadn't considered them before. And if it can pose hypotheses like that, they're not really answers, they're hypotheses, then they could be useful.
And we live in a hyper-specialized society, so if the dentist is looking at somebody with what's ostensibly a toothache, he's not thinking about the neurological aspects.
Right. That's the other thing. Last year there were 50,000 papers published on neuroscience alone. And so if you're a neuroscientist, you are just way overtaxed, just trying to keep up with your own specialty. But what's happening in somebody's brain or in somebody's nervous system might have to do with what's going on in their liver, their heart, or some other area, and you're certainly not reading those papers. A machine like Watson can actually cross into all types of domains and be a generalist in ways that humans can't afford to be.
The business side of all this, what kind of competition do you think is going to develop from the Googles or the HPs or the Apples or other companies?
You know, I think that everybody is, I think companies are going to look to ways to understand natural language and to provide some kind of answers that fit into their business model. Now, there was some speculation that IBM was actually building a machine that could compete with Google on the internet and provide much more specific and intelligent answers than simple web results that Google brings back. And I think that is a little bit off target, because IBM's machine takes 3 seconds to bring back one answer, and in those same 3 seconds, Google handles hundreds of thousands or perhaps even millions of web queries. And so the IBM thing cannot scale to the web the way it is now. At the same time, Google, they calculate how much computing power it costs them, each query costs them, and if they multiplied it by two or three or four, all of a sudden they wouldn't be making money on their search. Yet I talked to researchers at Google, and they are looking at ways in which they can come closer to providing answers. And they're going to start by doing it on questions that are simple and have simple sort of elementary answers, facts. But I think in time we are going to get used to this type of intelligence across our experience at work and on the internet. And I don't know who's going to be providing the service and who's going to be making money from it. There's no guarantee that IBM is going to be the king of this domain just because they got a head start on it.
We only have time for one or two more questions. Could you tell us a little bit about two of the important figures in developing Watson, David Ferrucci, who you mentioned, and Paul Horn?
Yeah. Paul Horn was the head of IBM research when this idea came up, and he was the one who pushed the idea of building a Jeopardy machine. And he ran into a lot of resistance because, first of all, IBM researchers take themselves very seriously and with good reason. And some of them didn't think that Jeopardy, a quiz show, really had the dignity of chess. And they thought it was a little bit kind of show busy for them. And what's more, they thought that building a Jeopardy machine that could beat humans was near impossible. So they basically ran away from Paul Horn, and he had the hardest time trying to get a team of researchers to tackle this problem. He tried again and again. Ferrucci himself turned him down once. But finally, Paul Horn prevailed. Now, Ferrucci is a very curious, brilliant and curious guy, and fortunately for me as an author, he's extremely articulate and at times loquacious. And so he was a great source for me. And he brings his own, first of all, he is a great leader with his team. He gets them extremely motivated, and he finds ways like that face-off that they had to work together and to put in long hours and to you know, spend 4 years pursuing this dream. Well, just one story about Ferrucci. His father pushed him to be a doctor, and Ferrucci was on the trail to be a doctor. But he loved computers. And one day he was in a class studying for his MCATs, his boards for medical school. And all of a sudden he realized it was absurd. He closed his book and just walked out of the class. And so he wanted to find something where he could use computers. But this is in the 1980s, and it didn't occur to him that he could do computer science. He thought, okay, what other field of medicine could I go into that could use computers? Could I go into physiology maybe? Where else could I use computers? And about a week later, he had what he called his second epiphany. He said, geez, you know, I don't need to go into some place that uses computers. I can just go into computers. I could be a computer scientist. The idea that this was such a far-fetched idea strikes me funny.
Certainly, looking back from our perspective today, was there a big computational side to what he did here in terms of use of algorithms, neural networks?
Well, the whole thing is just an enormous thicket of statistics and algorithms. I mean, I didn't go into the math that they used for this, but it's everything, absolutely everything is statistical, and there's a ton of machine learning in it. And the one thing that is not statistical, and the one thing that terrified the entire IBM team throughout this ordeal, was that this in the final match, where there are only 122 clues, well, that really is too small of a data set to fit into any statistics. And so it really, the final match would be a question of luck. Would Watson be lucky and get categories that were friendly to the computer, or would it come up with things that left it utterly confused? Would it be confused in the two final jeopardies? That might be crucial. And so whether their machine won or lost hinged on luck, while everything else that they did was rigorously applied statistics.
I don't know if the final match has already been recorded. Do you know yet who has won? Do you have your own speculation?
I was there, Barry, and we signed in blood a non-disclosure agreement, so I can't tell you who won. But I have written the last chapter, and the book is out. As the first 11 chapters are out as an e-book already on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And so people can get the first 11 chapters, and then the last chapter comes as soon as the match is over on the 16th as an update, and the books will be in the store the next day with the final chapter.
Final question, what will be your next project?
You know, I am not going back to Business Week. When I finished the Numerati, I went back to Business Week, but this time I'm not. And so I've got this big, yawning, open-ended life ahead of me, and I would love it if any of your listeners have ideas on what my next project should be. I'm all ears.
Well, I hope you've got a big inbox. I think we can help you.
Thanks, Barry.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Stephen Baker, author of the book Final Jeopardy, Man vs. Machine, and The Quest to Know Everything. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Barry.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.